With the coronavirus pandemic wreaking havoc on the world, people have been trying to find something to compare this surreal moment to. And a lot of them keep coming back to this.
Substitute Spanish flu for coronavirus, 1918 for 2020.
Over 100 years ago, the flu pandemic of 1918 killed millions of people. And it hit Philadelphia especially hard, killing 12,000 people in just the first 6 weeks. Why are so many people looking to 1918 in Philly to understand the pandemic we're living through today? I'm Annette John Hall. This is The Why. It was the fall of 1918. America was in the final throes of World War I. Philly was bustling with soldiers coming home and with newly arrived immigrants.
There are airplanes, there's radio, there's a world war going on. We're talking about a 20th century industrial city.
I talked to Robert Hicks. He's a historian and the creator of Spit Spreads Death, an exhibition about the 1918 flu pandemic at the Muter Museum here in Philadelphia. And some of the things you're about to hear about the pandemic may be disturbing to some listeners.
The flu pandemic of 1918 killed upwards of 50 to as many as 100 million people. We think in the United States, one of the training camps in Kansas may have been one of the first places for the flu to appear. But there were near simultaneous eruptions of this in other places, not just in the United States, but abroad.
Many people started calling it the Spanish flu, but...
There's nothing Spanish about it. Obviously, diseases do not respect nationalities. It was called the Spanish flu because in Spain, where the disease also erupted, very little censorship was exercised on the press.
Spain was neutral during World War I. According to Time magazine, the Spanish press reported on the outbreak, leading to the misconception that it originated there.
Other countries, particularly those at war, Britain, the United States, France, exercised a great deal of press censorship, and those reports were slow to appear in the press.
Philadelphia turned out to be the city hit hardest by the pandemic. What happened in Philly?
Well, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh had the highest mortality rates in the United States, but we do know that a British merchant ship came to Philadelphia at the end of summer with flu cases, and people had the presence of mind to quarantine the crew, quarantine those that needed treatment in a hospital, but it implanted the flu in town. Certainly after that ship, cases started to appear, and physicians were certainly on notice.
So how did it spread in Philadelphia so quickly?
One of the best ideas links the big outbreak of the flu to a fundraising parade, the 4th National Liberty Loan Fundraising Parade in Philadelphia. With World War I going on, everything was subordinate to the war effort. So Philadelphia had its parade, the largest in Philadelphia history. It's over 6 miles long, mostly military-related, to raise that patriotic spirit. And that occurred on September 28th. Now, at that parade, you had approximately 200,000 spectators. Undoubtedly, there were some people in that audience that had the flu and did not yet know it. But 3 days later, all the hospital beds are filled. This takes us into the first week of October, and then the mortality begins to skyrocket, literally, over the next few weeks. And beginning at that moment, for a six-week period, one Philadelphian dies every 5 minutes. That's about 12,000 deaths in about 6 weeks. And there's a photograph of one of these lampposts in Philadelphia just days after the parade, where you can see the patriotic banner, but overlaid on that banner is a Spit Spreads Death sign, a black lettering on a white background. It's very stark. Those signs began to get placed in public places, on the trolleys, And this would have been a familiar piece of advice for citizens who were accustomed to being told when there were other disease moments that just don't spit in public. Your spit carries some kind of germs. So we had an environment that had to flip almost immediately from this patriotic rah-rah atmosphere to something a lot more somber.
Unlike coronavirus, which appears to put older people most at risk, a lot of the press reports I've read about the 1918 flu said it attacked young people at high rates.
This was an unusual facet of the disease, that it struck healthy young adults very, very hard. Normally, when we go through a flu season, we're always told that the very young and the very old may be most at risk. Now, that's true. It was true in 1918, but there was a very large mortality spike for healthy young adults. To this day, nobody has a definitive explanation of why that was. But it was scary enough that somebody could go to work in the morning feeling all right, perhaps around noon feel a little queasy, headachy, be bedridden by the afternoon, and by supper time they might be dead. So the symptoms that advance so quickly in healthy young people really terrified people who saw this going on in their own families and their own neighborhoods. And sometimes it's hard to imagine that people simply couldn't function at all to save themselves when they were smitten with a flu. One nurse was making a neighborhood call, and a child came and grabbed this nurse and took the nurse into her own house. And the nurse discovered in one room that the parents were both there. The father was sitting in a chair, but he was already dead. The mother was sitting in another chair, and she was still alive, but she had given birth just 24 hours before, so she had a newborn infant. She was sitting next to a table, which had an apple on it, but this woman had no strength even to reach across the table and take hold of this apple and eat it. So these were scenes that greeted people that were either volunteers or health providers trying to deal with it.
Wow. So what was the treatment like?
There's effectively nothing that could be done except to ensure bed rest. People were getting fluids, getting something good to eat, and just wait it out. The nurses were, of course, the real heroes of the hour because they're making house calls, they're visible, they're wearing uniforms, and they're making sure people do these basics. That was all that could be done. It took about a month before the city began to revive in the sense that when it was clear that this disaster was hitting the city and it was disabling everything, because at least 25% of Philadelphians were coming down with the flu, everything was closing and the order was given for things to close. So church services, if they were held at all, were out of doors, no concerts, no school, public gatherings simply not taking place. People were told, of course, to, just as we have the social distancing now that we talk about with the coronavirus, they were practicing that then. Of course, you'd see people wearing gauze masks all the time as well. The police would escort out of public view anyone that appeared to be sick or faltering in public. So it was a fairly grim moment. But it's fascinating the way people behave when something like this is happening. There was a notable resilience of people to self-organize as the city was faltering. There had been a committee set up. This committee decided, wait a minute, why can't we organize something good here and do something about this plague? The headquarters for the volunteer effort was set up at Strawbridge's department store. A phone number was published, sort of, this is the flu central. This is the number you call if you need any kind of assistance that's flu-related. They organized food kitchens. Ambulances were almost non-existent, so private citizens volunteered their cars. To signal that they were ambulances, they would sport a green flag on the car that would give them the right of way. So you finally had citizens kicking in and willing to volunteer their health as well as their resources to do what could be done.
We'll be right back.
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Why. I'm Annette John Hall. I'm talking to Robert Hicks of the College of Physicians about the flu pandemic of 1918. So how did it eventually stop? How did this pandemic eventually wane?
Really, it was spring of 1919 before the weekly death toll in the city sort of returned to an average level for a city the size. So there continued to be moments of flu. It's worth remembering that the flu is pretty versatile virus, and even in the course of a single season, it can mutate. If any of your listeners received the flu shot during this past winter, they would have been immunized against H1N1. That variant was the same one that was the killer flu of 1918.
Robert, you came up with the idea to do the Spit Spreads Death exhibition about the 1918 flu epidemic in Philadelphia at the Muter Museum. Obviously, that was before the coronavirus became a household name. Why did you do the exhibition?
The flu pandemic of 1918 had been in my head as something we really ought to take a look at. And at the time I began thinking about it, about 5 years ago, there were Ebola outbreaks in Africa that were getting a lot of press attention. And I thought, well, here's a subject that's always going to be relevant. If we do an exhibit on the flu and have it up for about 5 years, at any given moment, a visitor to that exhibit will have seen or heard something about a disease outbreak somewhere in the world. Well, of course, I didn't plan on this with coronavirus, but in 2016, there was a world symposium of infectious disease experts. And one question posed was the likelihood of future pandemics. And the conclusion was that over the next 100 years, the planet would likely experience 4 pandemics, one of which will probably be flu. Well, that was just 4 years ago, and here we are with this pandemic of COVID-19.
Robert, what's the biggest lesson we can take from the flu epidemic of 1918 to help us stop the spread of coronavirus?
The biggest lesson we can take from 1918 is to recognize that disease is not a human being. It's something that invades bodies without regard to race, color, creed, national origin, nationality, anything. Supposedly, we have access to scientific information. We have access to education that was not available in 1918. Is that making us more considered and perspicacious citizens? I'm not sure. We've unfortunately had kind of a period of anti-science culture in this country. People simply distrusting that kind of expertise. And in a way, we have a test right now to see if particularly our people in Washington who have to vote on crucial issues on resources and help for us citizens, they need to be scientifically informed and they need to know who's an authority and who isn't. So this is a test to see if people in leadership positions can do the right thing.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for sharing this vital piece of history with us.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Robert Hicks is a historian and scholar at the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. Does your family have a story about the flu pandemic of 1918? Email me at ajohnhall@whyy.org. We'll pass on your story to the Muter Museum for an archive they're compiling. The Why is produced by me, Annette John Hall, along with Shai Binyakov, Alex Stern, and Kelsey Hansen, under the editorial direction of Katie Culinary. Our intern is Kelly Brennan. Hit me up on Twitter @AnnetteJH. Take care of yourselves.